This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT, 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. And I'm your host today, Matt Schaefer-Powell. Mention the name of entrepreneur and developer Scott West in Knoxville, and you're likely to get a variety of responses. He's either a pioneer or a crook, a visionary or a drug dealer, an innovator or a criminal. Well, he might be all of those things, and he's not afraid to admit it. A principal figure in the redevelopment of downtown Knoxville, West was arrested and sent to prison for taking part in a marijuana smuggling operation. Turns out he was laundering drug money through some of the very businesses that had helped him kick off the city's renaissance. So Scott West has documented his time in prison with a hilarious and at times very pointed series of observations. It's called The Crook Books, Scott West's Recipes for Disaster, Volume 1, Good Intentioned, Bad Guys. He's here for the next hour, and in a bit, he'll take your questions. So, Scott West, first of all, I want to thank you for joining us on Dialogue.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, good intentioned bad guy, is that you?
That's a lot of people throughout history. And by the way, you said criminal, like that was a bad thing.
Well, I have to say that a lot of people who would be listening right now would say absolutely it is, yeah.
But I'll start off with the controversial statement that 99% of criminals in the history of the world weren't really criminals.
How so? Go ahead and explain that.
Be they slaves that escaped the South in pre-Civil War, mm-hmm. or whether they were Jews that tried to hide their being Jewish in Nazi Germany, whether they were Christians in Rome, whether they were Aztecs facing conquistadors, they were criminals. And we don't see them as that now. A criminal, in my mind, is a bad intention, bad guy. So a criminal is a person who victimizes other people. So in my mind, Nelson Mandela wasn't really a criminal, even though he spent 27 years in prison.
This book, you call it a bathroom reader coffee table book, and mm-hmm. I can probably figure out what that means. But what does that mean to you?
That means it's supposed to be an entertainment. It's supposed to be light. Obviously, it took me years to work through the adventure sabbatical that I went through. It took me a while to work through that until I could see it in a humorous way. And so this is more or less, this book works as it's the chip knocked off of my shoulder. So that I can embrace life with giving off great energy again without having negativity around it. Nobody wants to be around a negative person, and I don't want to ever be a negative person. So I just see it as a very interesting chapter in my life.
It's you can't really call it a memoir.
No, I don't know what you call it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how do you explain it?
What I would describe it as, if I had to use one sentence, I would say it's a celebration of the criminal classes mm-hmm. and their contributions to history and society.
So I need to ask this question. It says Volume 1.
Oh, yeah. It's a rather long-winded title, but then again, I'm rather long-winded.
So, which is great for a program along. Like Dialogue, because we have a whole hour to talk.
Well, I need to talk too, though. Can you give me two? No, I guess I can shorten my answers to fit 1 hour.
So yes, is there going to be a volume
two? Yeah, there's volume one, there's volume two, there's volume three that are already written. I wrote these in prison, and when I got out, my family said, don't publish yet. It's too soon. Mm-hmm. You're still too far ahead of your time. Well, I was going to get so much abuse from this, basically arguing that marijuana is not really a crime anyway. It wasn't a crime before 1938. It's not going to be a crime soon. And then what are you going to say? Will I still be an ex-con? I guess. But the crime will no longer be a crime. So that's the type of thing that I dive into in the book repeatedly. I have a rabid focus, so I'm constantly circling around my points, which I don't have as you can tell talking to me, I don't have a linear mind. I kind of have a chaotic thinking process, but circles around the same ideas.
It all makes sense. I mean,
how to speak prison, which I can't do on air here with you.
Yeah, but right. Yeah, absolutely.
I explain how to do that in the book, and mm-hmm. and then I have sections on Rogue's Gallery, which tells about the good intention bad guys. Which, when I say good intention bad guy, what that means is a person who breaks the law for good reasons. My feeling is that a person who breaks the law and helps many people is better than a person who follows the law and helps no one but themselves. That's my basic point of view on it. And of course, there's a bad intention bad guy, which is someone who victimizes someone else. They steal your TV. They mug you in the alley. They kill you. Mm-hmm. That obviously is a crime. Anyone would agree that that's a crime. The part that we have difficulty with saying is a crime are those things that change over time. You know, it's no longer a crime to be a Christian, for instance. It's no longer a crime in Germany to be Jewish. So those types of things change over time. But the person who victimizes another person remains a crime. So that's the bad intention, bad guy.
Let's go back in time a little bit to right around 1990, the 90s, when you and Bernadette were really, the tip of the spear for revitalization in Knoxville.
We've got a chapter called Pioneers. They're the ones with the arrows in their backs. Speaking of tip of the spear, but what happened back in the early 1990s, Bernadette and I have been involved in downtown for a very long time, at least feels like a very long time to me.
I should mention, I'm not sure if I identified Bernadette as your wife.
Bernadette is my wife. She was a flight attendant for 21 years, which I feel very bad about the fact that she lost that job that she loved because of my conspiracy. Mm-hmm. She was the way it worked is she had to be found guilty as well for them to seize our assets. Without going into great detail, here's how it works. There's a 98.3% conviction rate in the federal justice system. 98.3%. Not Perry Mason, not Law and Order. 98.3%. So they sit you at a table and they say, here's what's going to happen, Scott. You're going to get 25 years no parole if you don't plead guilty. Mm-hmm. And Bernadette's going to plead guilty. Bernadette could beat us in court, but we're still going to not give you a plea deal unless she pleads guilty as well. So that we can, they don't say this, but it's so they can seize our assets. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of people don't know this, but the businesses didn't launder money. The crime of the money laundering was the buildings themselves. We had spent a year, Bernadette and I, having coffee with this older Turkish gentleman. Perhaps our greatest feat of our career in downtown Knoxville was acquiring those buildings, which were condemnable. And after we finally talked to Fikret Jinkay, and people that are old-timers will remember him in downtown Knoxville, mm-hmm. when we finally acquired those buildings, the next day they put a do not enter on the buildings. They basically condemned the building the day after we acquired them, which we were going to fix them up anyway, but that just tells you how bad a shape they were in. There was a giant holes in the roofs, like a funnel. And I just told Fikret, I said, look, I don't care what shape the buildings are in inside, I just want the buildings.
For those who don't remember this or maybe weren't around in Knoxville at the time, what buildings are we talking about, roughly?
Six
I know there were more
There was 16, 18, 20, 22, 28, and 36 Market Square.
Market Square, right. Okay.
Yeah, and then we developed World Grotto in 16. We developed Oodles, which is now Uncorked. It's mm-hmm. the same business, Oodles Uncorked. In 18, 20, we developed Earth to Old City, which we had for 25 years now. Mm-hmm. In 22 Market Square, we opened Preservation Pub. In 28 Market Square, and we've opened Market House Cafe in 36 Market Square. Now, what I would tell you about that is, back then, no bank would loan us money in the early 1990s. Mm-hmm. Everyone was ashamed of downtown. You'd have to be around a while to grasp this. It was like Market Square was like a post-apocalyptic homeless place. Mm-hmm. Like the tumbleweeds blew across after 5 p.m., and I remember developing the buildings. I couldn't go home at night because Bernadette would stay up all night working. And so I had to stay with her because I couldn't leave her by herself. The Market Square was covered in dozens of homeless people sleeping mm-hmm. at night. So so I would stay there all night with her while she did treatments of the walls and so forth and opened Preservation Pub. But we tried to get the Randy Burlesons, with Aubrey's, and we tried to get Mike Chase with Calhoun's and so forth. We tried to get Kenny with Stir Fry, and no one would open a business on Market Square with us. So we had to create all of the businesses to inhabit the buildings ourselves.
What did you see in downtown Knoxville that these other folks were not seeing?
Well, Bernadette grew up in Germany, in Europe, so she was used to the town square, and she couldn't believe that our town square was boarded up. And that's another thing that's important to grasp here, is that Market Square was basically boarded up. There was Soup Kitchen, Subway, there was Tomato Head. The difference in what we did versus other businesses downtown is that we threw off an enormous amount of energy out. In other words, we didn't just promote we didn't just bring people into the business. We promoted downtown. We were the downtown Knoxville cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. We were known as that. I was called Pollyanna all through the 1990s, which means I was so optimistic that people thought I was totally unrealistic and it couldn't happen like I was describing it. And then it exceeded that. So, that's good to see happen because at the time, people didn't want to be downtown. So we were on the tip of the spear in terms of that. And the reason we were able to do that is because I can't see this in myself, but I know it because other people didn't do it here. And if someone doesn't do it, it doesn't happen. And that is that we have maybe it's kind of obvious knowing that we did the federal prison time, but we have a very high risk tolerance, which doesn't feel like a high risk tolerance to me, but obviously I'm not concerned with the risk that other people are.
Do you think that's in your DNA?
I don't see, there's reasons for it though. It's like we have a high risk tolerance. We have an incredible work ethic. You know, we have a stick-to-itiveness. We refuse to fail. And we, so that is, you know, a big part of success is you just keep at it. We kept our nose to the grindstone when we should have been having nervous breakdowns, and we made it.
So what happened in 2006 then? Can you walk us through that briefly?
Yeah, well, we were downtown for a long time before that. All through the 90s, we were in the Old City. We had three businesses. I was the Old City Neighborhood Association president. When Ash was mayor, I was in the downtown task force. It was called Nine Counties, One Vision. I was the downtown director of that with Lawrence Tulloch. We realized that what had to happen first and foremost was downtown Knoxville had to revitalize. And Bernadette and I, after 10 years in the Old City, we were like, it's not going to happen here first. It has to happen on Market Square first.
Yeah.
So we pulled up stakes with our businesses in the Old City and moved up to Market Square. Now, understand, this is before Haslam. You know, this is before Haslam had his, and Rojero both kicked off their mayoral campaigns in the pub, Preservation Pub, back then. Mm-hmm. So this is a long time ago. I mean, when David Dewhurst arrived in Knoxville, I had three businesses and was the Neighborhood Association president. We've been down there for that long.
Yeah.
So when we went up to Market Square and started developing, I remember a few things that give you an idea of the age of this. I remember Ashley Capps came up to me and asked me to write a letter to help him get $125,000 for a series of concerts on Market Square.
Should mention, too, that he was working at WUOT at the time.
Sundown in the City. Yeah. And I wrote that, and then I went in front of city council, and I said, we're going to spend $6 million on these six buildings on Market Square, and it's very important that you understand that we are doing this investment based upon events like Sundown in the City happening here. So, you know, we threw that out there before the city invested in the parking garage, the Regal Cinemas, or even the Market Square itself.
What about the arrest? Tell me.
And in 2006, after we were deep in the revitalization of Market Square. And then in 2006, they came out that I had basically laundered $2.1 million of marijuana profits into buildings on Market Square. Again, a building is kind of like you think of Simon Malls. Sears is not Simon Malls.
Right.
Sears is in Simon Malls.
Mm-hmm.
So if Simon Malls got in trouble, Sears wouldn't go down. So that's why people had trouble understanding why Preservation Pub or Uncorked or the World Grotto were not seized. It's because they weren't part of the money laundering.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, were you partners in those businesses as well?
Well, my family owns everything. So there's my mom, my dad, my three sisters, my wife. There's a bunch of us. You know, I'm just kind of I'm the talkative one. So everybody knows who I am.
I'm glad to hear that because I can't imagine what Thanksgiving would be like if you're the shy, quiet, demure one.
We play games and we yell a lot. It's fun though.
So
what happened is this conspiracy. Now, remember what I told you earlier is that we couldn't get a bank to loan us money. So being the creative entrepreneur that I am, I creatively financed part of what we did. So basically, I got $2.1 million from my brother in cash. And instead of investing it in Swiss bank accounts or an Aruba bank or hiding it somewhere or going to Las Vegas and blowing it on wild parties, we took condemned buildings on Market Square and fixed them up and restored them. And that took my conspiracy, which was 25,000 pounds of marijuana and $2.1 million. It took it from a 10-year sentence with no parole to 25 years because of the money laundering. The conspiracy itself for the marijuana was 10 years, and then we wound up with 15. You know, it was 25 years no parole because of having not blown the money, having created taxable properties and businesses and employees and sales taxes and all those types of things. It made the crime worse, which I think it's kind of funny.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Our guest today is Scott West. He's here to talk about his new book, The Crook Books, Volume 1, Scott West's Recipes for Disaster. If you want to participate in the conversation, you can tweet us at WUOTFM. Send us a Facebook message. There's also a little box on our homepage. And as always, you can call us. The number is 974-5050. It's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, and joined today by entrepreneur and ex-con, Scott West. As you may or may not know, Scott and his wife, Bernadette, are among the pioneers who established the redevelopment of downtown Knoxville, but they may be just as famous for their high-profile arrest on drug smuggling and money laundering charges. If you have a question or comment, you can catch us on Twitter or on Facebook. And if you go to our webpage, there's a neat little question box you can fill out, and we will do our best to get your question to Scott. And, of course, you can call us. Number is 974-5050. It's 974-5050. And I want to be sure to mention that Scott will be back with us again tonight as Todd Steed's guest on tonight's installment of Studio 865 Flipside. You can hear that tonight on WUOT at 8:30. So, Scott, we were talking just before the break. We were talking a little bit about what happened. Let me ask you this. Where were you when you got word that you were in trouble?
It was fascinating. There were friends of mine started texting me. I was in Atlanta. I was in Atlanta at a show to buy things for Earth to Old City, which is the family's gift shop. We had three at one point. Now we have one on Market Square, but it's a unique gift store. So I was in Atlanta looking for stuff for the shop, and I got phone calls that said there are literally dozens of DEA, IRS, and police in, you know, black suits and bulletproof vests and boots and everything kicking down your door and in your businesses on Market Square. And Bernadette was in Rome at the time. I think she was flying in Europe. And so she, when she arrived back, she had her phone off, and she got a barrage of phone calls when she stepped off the plane in Cincinnati, which is where she flew out of, about the same thing. And then, of course, there were some phone calls. I just remembered this for the first time in ages, but there were phone calls to me in Atlanta, and they said, you need to come back right now. There's been a break-in in your business. And I said, well, what if I was in Iceland? I couldn't come back for the break-in. So can you not handle this without me being there? And then the police officer said, Scott, you're wanted for by the federal authorities, you need to come up here and turn yourself in.
Yeah, we're the ones actually breaking in.
Yeah, first they were luring me back, and then when I said, why would I come back, then they told me what it was, and I said, okay, and I called my friend Don Bosch, who's an attorney downtown, mm-hmm. pretty well known,
yeah.
And he said, come on up and meet me, and I'll go with you to turn yourself in.
So the original indictment suggested that you had been involved in illegal drug trade for at least a decade before this. I'm wondering, as you're sort of rising through the ranks in terms of downtown development, mm-hmm. you're getting this profile, this image that a lot of people had as a pioneer,
yeah.
that in the back of your mind, you must have been thinking, one of these days, the bottom could fall out on this. Was that something that scared
That's not
you?
How my brain works.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think about how I'm going to fail or how this is going to go wrong. I just try to succeed. And I had for many years been out of that, you know, I'd been involved with it. But then once I got involved in downtown with Earth to Old City and our other businesses and the development of the buildings, and I did business in downtown Knoxville. My brother was still in that and I wasn't. But then later when it occurred to me that I could help him and help achieve our goals of revitalizing downtown, then I made a critical error in saying, hey, I said, meet with me, just be you and I, no one else will know, not your wife, not my wife, no one will know that you're giving me cash, and you'll know that you're my partner, but nobody else will. Mm-hmm. But I didn't think about the fact that human nature being what it is, he would brag about owning Market Square to his friend wearing a wire, you know, so I didn't think about that possibility, which is male ego, you know, of course it's going to happen like that,
But you never mapped that out.
I
thought
it was a perfect crime.
Yeah.
And I also felt really good about it because I felt like this money is now taxable. People have trouble with the idea of money laundering. That, in my mind, the whole idea of it being a crime is because they're trying to find the crime behind the money. Mm-hmm. So you had to make money laundering a crime to have leverage to get to the crime. So, you know, what you're really doing is you're taking this money that's already in existence. You can't claim your income from marijuana smuggling. Which, by the way, smugglers are not thieves. I just want to point out that
you have a section in your book that says smugglers are not thieves.
Yeah. Smuggling is, you know, John Hancock was a smuggler. So yeah, there's a whole lot of smugglers back in the Founding Fathers days. But you know, anyway, so the whole nature of that was that I thought that I could do this and do this great good. And, of course, remember this, too, that 2/3 of the money that went into the buildings on Market Square was legal.
Yeah.
Legal. There were millions of dollars in legal monies, and there was 1/3 of the money was illegal. But one drop of money laundering in the well poisons all the water, is what I was told by the prosecutors.
Well, and there are those who still to this day will say Scott and Bernadette had an unfair advantage in developing and
in the
competition.
Yeah, I remember running into a friend of mine who's a manager in another downtown bar, and he came up to me and said, "You know, I'm really mad at you, man." I'm like, "You know, I just got out of prison. I just did 4.5 years," and I'm like, "Oh, you know,
here we go.
Please."
What?
He said, "So, why are you mad at me?" And he said, "Because you cheated." And I said, "Okay, let's just say I cheated. What's your excuse going to be this time when I kick your butt?" That's my feelings about that. I would have succeeded. I would have done the same thing that I did with the money laundering. Without it, it just would have taken me a couple more years. It just was a mistake on my part to speed it up. But I want to be clear that in my mind, there are very big differences between law, crime, ethics, and morality. These are very different things to me. I mean, I would never I would never steal from my friends, hurt my friends, hurt anyone, take from anyone. I would earn. And the system itself, I disagreed with that. I mean, a lot of people say, "Well, who are you to say what's right and, you know, what's law and what's illegal?" If people don't do that, then nothing in the world ever changes. If the founding fathers didn't rebel against England, there'd be no United States. So somebody has to say, "I disagree with this law. I think it's wrong." And they have to push against it or it never changes.
So you said the way your mind worked, you weren't really sort of planning for the possibility that you could fail, but you knew at the time that what you're doing is by the letter of the law, it's illegal.
I was a criminal. I am an ex-con.
Yeah,
I'm not arguing that point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying I'm in very, very good company. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying.
So you and Bernadette were both sent to prison, and at the same time, I'm wondering what that was like as far as a relationship.
Well, that's part of the book too. Is you have the love story, which is two convicts in separate prisons.
Mm-hmm.
That's the love story. The thing about prison but if you want to get into what makes it, what I believe is inhumane, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody says, "Oh, we're civilized." That, you know, meaning I think humane. I would tell you that if you give me a choice, 25 years no parole in a humane prison, which removes all human touch from you. Mm-hmm. You're no longer human when you remove touch.
Mm-hmm.
They remove tactile sensation from you. You can't hug you can't sleep with your wife. You can't be with your kids. You can't be with your parents when they pass away. You are put in a cell or a room, and that's taken from you. Now, lots of people are like, "That's great. I'm glad they're being punished." And so, but understand, these people get out. You've taken the humanity from a person when you put them in prison for 20 years or so. And I would take any day if you said, "We're going to pull your fingernails out and for a week and break your fingers, or you can do 25 years in prison, no parole." I don't know about you, but I'm going to be like, "Okay, pass the wasabi. Let's pull the fingernails out," you know?
Yeah, well, you know, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because as I was looking through the book, I could almost come to the conclusion that you enjoyed the experience.
Well,
of prison.
I got a headline on the News Sentinel during this whole thing. I was in Blount County Jail, and they said, "Scott West says, I'm a cockroach." Because I have a theory that if you take the richest guy and you put him on the street homeless, and you take the homeless guy and put him in a big mansion on a hill, in 3 months, the rich guy will say, "Man, those beans we found in the dumpster this morning were delicious, weren't they?" And the homeless guy that's now in the big mansion on the hill will say, "The caviar was subpar, Alfred." So in other words, I think human beings are very adaptable. So I was going to use my time, not lose it. That's what it boils down to. I wasn't going to lose any time. I wasn't going to have that time taken from me. I was going to make it work for me, and I came out of it better, stronger, you know, hopefully a little wiser from it. I obviously won't repeat the crimes, because even though I believe marijuana should be legal and will be legal, I don't have enough life in me for that kind of thing, you know. I have no interest in that, but that doesn't change my feeling about that it won't be a crime. Then just like moonshine. You know, when I was sitting in prison on my prison bunk, and I'm reading this story with all these politicians in Knoxville that were singing the accolades of opening the Moonshine Trail.
Right.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Sure do.
So people would say, "Oh, you hurt downtown Knoxville." I would say the exact same thing. Why do people go to the OK Corral? It's a scene of a crime. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting to go where Billy the Kid was, right? So my feeling is that this story does not hurt downtown Knoxville. This story makes downtown Knoxville way more interesting.
You know, I can imagine decades from now, tour guides giving tours of Knoxville are going to tell your story.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
I feel like I'm going to write that tour. I wrote a tour.
Good, bad, and the ugly? Yeah, you're not going to sugarcoat it.
My tour is called Lost Tales of Scruffy City. And I've already written it. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it kind of talks about the things that people actually find of interest. I mean, most of us, some of us want to know what year that column is, if it's Corinthian or Ionian or Ionic or whatever. But most of us want to know who slept with who shot who, who stole what from whom. That's what we're really into. So my tour is about all that stuff. The stuff that maybe you can't tell if you're the Knoxville Visitor Center, you want to tell them all the well-lit, clean history. But when you're the Scruffy City Visitor Center, then you get to tell the fun stuff that people actually want to do. I think a lot more tourists are going to come to Knoxville based on the stories that I'm going to tell than are going to come to Knoxville based on stories that cover up. When you white out the interesting parts of history, remember when you were in school and how did history classes become so boring? They're amazingly interesting, yeah. And they somehow white out all the interesting stuff.
All the good stuff.
And the people that are, what I've done, in essence, with this book and the beginning of the three books, and there'll be Crook albums as well, mm-hmm. But what I've done is I'm not allowing myself to be whited out. I'm not going to let that happen. I haven't let that happen because it's important that people understand that change comes from, we celebrate the breaking of the rule 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
But the person's a horrible, even people that think marijuana should be legal wanted me lynched when I got caught for the marijuana conspiracy. And I thought, that's hypocritical. If you think that in pre-Civil War South, that an escaped slave was stolen property, which no one would think now, the question is, if you went back into pre-Civil War South, you helped a slave on the Underground Railroad, that makes you a criminal. So you just have to have enough of the future to understand. I'm not comparing myself to Harriet Tubman.
Sure, right, right.
Understand that. I'm saying that Harriet Tubman was a criminal. George Washington was a criminal. Jesus Christ was crucified because he was a criminal. And you have to have enough of the long view to understand that I know I'm right, whether other people know I'm right or not. And this is where I get accused of the arrogance and all that. Mm-hmm. I know that I'm right, and I know that in the end, my version is the true version and the right version because there are no victims. If the person helps the many and doesn't hurt anyone, how is that person worse than the person that helps no one?
974-5050 is the number to call, 974-5050. If you have a question or a comment for Scott West, you can also go to our Twitter page, which is at WUOTFM. And, of course, if you go to WUOT.org, there's a little box there where you can type in your question. And we have a couple of those questions that I want to make sure that I get to in just a bit. But I want to point out that your book is comes off to me as unrepentant. There's not a dramatic mea culpa in there. If somebody's looking for a mea culpa, they're not going to find it in there.
Okay, in terms of being sorry, I am very sorry about what happened to my family. I'm very sorry about what happened to my mother and my wife. If I could, take away the hurt that they went through, I would. That said, that doesn't mean that I feel that the actions I did were criminal, but they weren't evil or wrong. Now, my intentions were very good, and the outcome was very good. And people say, well, the outcome doesn't matter. Yes, it does. It does matter. It does matter. The outcome is important.
Here's one of the questions we have. This is from Lisa, who contacted us from West Knoxville. Says, when do you think recreational marijuana will become legal in the state of Tennessee?
Well, it may have been delayed recently. I would have said within the next 5 years, maybe 2 years, but the election cycle has now thrown a kink into that. I'd say within the next 10 years, though. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine. Just think for a moment about politicians, whatever politician, any Democrats, Republicans, I don't care. What do they want? They want taxes. So whatever they say, if a Republican goes in office, defense spending goes up, a Democrat goes in office, you have some form of spending goes up, like the healthcare system or something. They will find the money to spend. They're not going to decrease the spending. So what's going to happen is they're going to see the billions of dollars being generated in taxes in Colorado, in California, and the whole country is going to say, we want some of that.
So,
and that's what's going to drive it is money. The reason slavery existed for centuries is because they ceased to see human beings as human beings because there was so much money mm-hmm. being made from that. I'm talking from Africa to Asia to Europe and America. They didn't see them as human beings because it wasn't in their interest to, because they made money from selling chattel. Human beings as chattel. And what's going to happen is they're going to see that marijuana is a huge boom in their tax revenue, and they can do all these things they want to do with the money. They're not going to give back the other money. They just want more money. It's going to be legalized for that reason, if nothing else.
So 10 years, now 11 years have gone by since you were arrested and convicted, and attitudes about marijuana have changed dramatically.
Especially in this area.
And I want to ask you, do you feel like that exonerates you, or is it frustrating to you? I mean, do you look back on it and say, man, if people
have thought
differently?
I'm not looking for exoneration in the sense that, you know, it's already happened. You know, but people don't want to argue with me about, well, you broke the law. Yeah, I broke the law. I also did the time. I'm fine with that. Look, I'm not bitter about doing the time. I wrote a funny book about doing the time. So we haven't really gotten into the humor of this, but yeah. I tried to find humor in all of this, and I wrote the book as entertainingly and humorous as I could. While still getting my point across, which I think any good comedy should have an underlying point. And I try to make my points while not being, I'm really not trying to be preachy. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to hold myself up and as better than someone else. I'm not. My father taught me from the time I was a young child that I'm no better than a homeless guy or the mayor. Mm-hmm. They were all just people. But I do believe that it will be legalized. It should be legalized. It's ridiculous that it's illegal already. And that it wasn't illegal till certain persons in 1938 decided to make it illegal because of certain subgroups of people, meaning blacks and Hispanics, were the target of making marijuana illegal. And Hearst wanted hemp removed from, you know, competition with wood because he had all the newspapers and he owned all these forest lands. And before that, back in 1908, they made opiates illegal. Well, obviously, opiates were a fraction of the power of the current crop of Oxycontins and, you know, heroin substitutes. Where we are now is so much more potent, and it's the legal stuff that's potent. It's not the stuff that they made illegal back in 1908, which was because of Asians working on the railroads.
But there is, we've done a lot of reporting on the opiate crisis, and you're well aware of that. Do your ideas about marijuana extend to opiates?
My feeling on everything involving America is I believe the flag stands for freedom. And when I say freedom, I mean individual freedom. And that doesn't mean freedom to victimize someone else. That's not freedom. I'm talking about freedom within your own body. If you want to go skydiving, even though that's very dangerous, you should get to do that. If you want to snowboard, even if you want to gain 400 pounds and go snowboarding, you should be able to do that. Mm-hmm. That's your body. You should be able to do that. I don't want to dictate to you what you can do to your own body. And that's really where I'm coming from. Yes, there are addictive personalities in this country. And 60% of them are overweight. But there's some that are on opiates, mostly legal opiates. Yeah. So my argument would be most people don't know this, but they've done blind studies where if you put a person that's on Ritalin or Adderall with a person and you give them meth, it's the same thing. They can't tell what they took. So a person that's legally taking one prescription can't tell that he's taking the illegal one. It's the same drug. It's just you call it a medicine or you call it a drug. And then whether a doctor prescribes it or not, I'm not saying it's okay to be a drug dealer. I'm not saying that it should or shouldn't be illegal. I'm saying that from my point of view, I don't like someone else telling me what to do in my bedroom or in my personal life. And I don't think other people, generally speaking, people like rules for other people, not for themselves, right? Whatever it is they're into, they think should be legal. And then the other guy, well, that's kinky what he's doing over there. He shouldn't be allowed to do that. So they always want to make a rule for somebody else. I'm for fewer rules, unless they actually have a victim. You know, make a law that has a victim. In downtown Knoxville, one of the things I remember is they're all the time going on about graffiti in the alleys. Well, that graffiti in the alleys turned out to be Artist Alley, which is the most touristed thing in downtown Knoxville. Now it's amazing. So you're going on and on about this vandalism that's occurring, right? Which is art. So my point is that people are always looking to make rules. At the time, I was in these neighborhood associations, and I'm making the argument, why don't we concern ourselves with bringing people downtown to enjoy downtown instead of trying to make a rule to fine a landlord because he let somebody draw graffiti in his alley or whatever? I'm about making downtown successful, not trying to find some way to penalize or put someone in jail. You know, my thing is about benefiting the downtown itself.
Well, we're going to take another quick break here on Dialogue. Our guest today is Scott West, here to talk about his new book, The Crook Books, Volume 1, Scott West's Recipes for Disaster. If you want to participate in the conversation, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or fill out the little box on our homepage. And as always, you can call us at 974-5050. It's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, joined today by entrepreneur and ex-con Scott West. If you have a question, you can catch us on Twitter, on Facebook, go to our webpage, all those ways, or you can just call us at 974-5050, 974-5050. And speaking of which, let's go to Don, who's calling us from Claxton. Don, welcome to Dialogue. And I thought Don was there. Maybe not. Okay. Well, anyway.
I can be Don.
Go ahead.
I can ask myself a question and say I'm Don.
Oh, and I also want to mention that Scott West is going to be back with us tonight. He's going to be Todd Steed's guest on tonight's installment of Studio 865 Flipside. And you can hear that tonight at 8:30 on WUOT. And Scott and Todd will be talking about a lot different sorts of things.
Todd is and I talk about music.
Yes, exactly. So, excuse me. In this book, you pose a lot of interesting and ethical challenges. For instance, you take a look at the hypocrisy of cheating.
Yeah.
And as a reader, I found that kind of interesting as you were challenging me. Was that your intent? Was your intent to
My
say?
My intent was to say that it's very hard to see the world in black and white. I know people we all like to do it, but I basically, I just remember the incredible anger that people have towards Deflategate or the bicycling Tour de France stuff. And, and it turns out that, 60% of the guys that were winning were on and doing the same thing. So it's don't think that it's an isolated incident. I mean, these guys want to win. So they're doing what they got to do to win. And I just started taking it apart thinking, how is it different to do the steroid than it is to drink coffee versus a person who lives at high altitude versus a person who lives at ground, sea level.
Yeah, the question being is the person who trains at high altitude, are they cheating?
Sherpa will outclimb you. You know why? Because they have probably twice as many red blood cells as you because they live on Mount Everest. You know, they live on a mountain. They live at high altitude, so they have more red blood cells. So they would probably make really good runners, I bet. But that's basically my point is that in the end, I think that chapter, my ultimate argument was, is God cheating by making some of us taller and stronger and faster and smarter than others? Because some guys are going to be better at basketball than me, no matter how hard I train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a question from Alexis, who contacted us from East Knoxville. I notice whistleblowers like Snowden and Manning are demonized by good, honest people. They broke the law for the good. How do we get the public off this era of media-driven Kool-Aid of attacking the well-intentioned criminals instead of the real ones?
That's not going to happen.
Use the example of the NSA.
Yeah, you're not going to have that happen because kind of like, when you think about your parents and children, the children don't want to live by the rules of the parents, so they rebel. At some point in their adolescence, they rebel. And a country has rules, and people rebel, and it constantly changes. If the laws were exactly right, then why do they write new laws every year? They write new laws every year. And part of it is because politicians want their name on something to give them a legacy. And to get reelected because they did something, so they have to create something, even if it didn't need to be created, so that they could get reelected because they did this thing to stop this, So I just can't imagine that those in power, those that make laws, why would they secede or why would they give up that power and tell you, we're not going to, and plus you can't have chaos. Obviously, I like having a police force too. Believe me, I'm not anti-police force. I'm not anti-military. I'm not anti-law. I'm just anti-laws that don't make sense. If you make up a law that doesn't protect people from victimization, then why is there a law there? That's my question.
We're going to try this again. Don is calling from Claxton, and hopefully we can get Don's call on the air. If you'd like to talk to Scott West, if you have a question or comment, the number is 974-5050. And how about this? Don, are you there?
I am indeed.
Excellent.
Hello,
Go ahead. Go ahead, Don.
Hey. Yeah, did I hear correctly that you were charged with 25,000 pounds?
Well, yes, but there's a reason that you get charged with that. Conspiracy law was created to go after mafia dons, the RICO laws and so forth, which what that does is any person in the conspiracy that it does a crime, you become responsible for that crime. In other words, I never saw nor touched the 25,000 pounds. Yet I'm charged with the 25,000 pounds because I'm part of the conspiracy. That's how it works. That's how it works. That's the law.
One other thing, I didn't hear how much time you actually did.
Well, I was facing 25 to life, and then when my wife pled out with me and I pled out, then I wound up with 75 months in federal prison, and I served 4.5 years because of, I don't think it's called good time and so forth, but I served four and a half years.
Well, Don, thank you so much for the call from Claxton this afternoon. And Scott, if I were to do a search, a word search on a digital version of your book, and I search the word snitch or snitches, I'm guessing it would be right up there with the and a.
Yeah.
Here's my question: you were ratted out,
yeah,
so to speak.
I was a little angry at my childhood friend that basically, for no reason other than that I could see, other than his own cowardice, fear, and I believe, you know, there's Schadenfreude in there. I think there's an entitlement that occurs when someone is given something for a long period of time, and if they think that they're going to lose that, they want revenge for that. And my brother had told his friend that he was going to get out of the marijuana business, and they needed to find another job. So that friend said, well, can I at least drive the money out to Arizona then to make some extra money? And so my brother let him. And just so you guys know, that's not a real job in a drug conspiracy. Nobody gets to just drive money. You drive money out and you drive marijuana back. That's how it works.
Right, right.
But he let him drive the money out, and he got pulled over. And he rolled. And he didn't just roll on my brother. He rolled on everyone he knew. And everyone he ever knew was facing 25 years to life because he got pulled over with $362,000 in his trunk, which, by the way, that's a lot of money, I know. It's also the number of pages in my book, which is kind of interesting.
Coincidentally or no?
No. Actually, my book is about 362 pages. But anyway, so he rolled on everybody, and I was kind of a little angry about that. So I guess I exercised those demons in the book. The longest chapter is a poem called Snitch.
Do you feel like you did exercise those demons? Do you feel anger is still there?
I like to think that he feels bad about what he did. That makes me feel better, but he probably doesn't. You know, human beings can justify anything, just about anything we do. So I don't doubt that he justified it. But fact of the matter is, the snitch idea I have in the book is that Nation of Snitches is one of the chapters. And the idea is this: when you're in preschool and middle school and you're with your friends, the worst name you can be called by your friends is a tattletale. I just hate that, tattletale. And then you move on, and the whole idea of the tattletale moves forward in life, and it's not perceived as a good quality to have, to be a snitch. Yet, our entire legal justice system is based upon it. That's, to me, is there some kind of, there's a problem in that. I see an ethical problem with that.
Well, let me ask you this. If you did the crime,
mm-hmm.
You were guilty of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
You violated the law.
Mm-hmm.
Does it, in the grand scheme of things, does it matter? Yeah, the fact that he ratted you out did affect your life, but does it matter from the sense that nobody put a gun to your head and said,
well,
Scott, do this?
But again, you're going back to the argument that says crime is bad, right? So crime is bad. You broke the law. It's good that you got caught and went to prison. But again, I would say, Harriet Tubman, pre-Civil War South, she's leading 13 slaves on the Underground Railroad to freedom. She gets ratted out. Now those 13 slaves get lynched or beaten. Was that okay? That would be my argument there. It's like, it's not okay to snitch out the Jews that are trying to get out of Nazi Germany. It's not okay to snitch out the Christians in Rome. It's not okay to snitch out your friends. You know, one of my friends I'm in a band with, been in a band with him for 25-plus years, he was an Army Ranger, and they have a very, I can't repeat it here, the word they use for a buddy, blanker, a guy that hurts his friends. You know, this is, in military, the only thing that matters in our most powerful military in the history of the world, you know, you have a group of guys that you have to be able to rely on each other, period. So, you know, most men and women would agree that you don't hurt your closest kinships. I mean, I don't want to be friends with somebody that thinks it's okay to put their mom in prison. I don't want to be friends with somebody that, because their dad borrows 20 bucks from them because he's on the run, that they call their dad in, or their sister or their child. I don't want to know a person that would destroy their family for something like, my dad's wanted for marijuana smuggling and I should have turned him in. So I did. You know, to me, that's not an ethical person. That doesn't impress me at all. That's just a herd animal. And when I say herd animal, I mean this. In terms of downtown Knoxville revitalization and in terms of my views. You're the wildebeest and the zebras going across to find the fresh grass to eat in Africa. There's the it's dry. There's the water. Somebody's got to cross that water, and it's filled with crocodiles. Somebody's got to jump in the water first and take the chance to change the future for those other wildebeest and antelope and zebras. So somebody's taking the risk of being eaten by crocodiles, so then the whole herd will go after them and enjoy the fruits of the risk that that first one took. The pioneer is the person that takes the risk that everyone else benefits from later.
So when we think of you as a pioneer, as a, you know, as a developer, but I mean, do you see yourself as a pioneer in that regard as well?
There's a lot, more than 50% of America are pioneers now in agreement with me on this. Most people think marijuana should be legal. So, I mean, I was a pioneer back when it was 20% and 30%, but now the world is with me. That's why I waited till now to publish, because I just didn't want to publish and put that on my family again, you know, a few years ago. Now we're at a point where I believe the tide has turned, and most people agree with me, and soon 80% of people are going to agree with me. It's going to be as close to 100% as you can get in a democracy. And most people are going to agree with me that it should be legal, and then it's going to be legal.
I want to try to get one more of our online questions in before we wrap up the show, which is flown by. And this is from Kathleen, who sent this question from Knoxville. When Mr. West's business appeared profitable during the time when he was trafficking drugs, other businesses may have rented space or made business decisions based on the perception of his success on Market Square. Does he feel responsible for any false impressions his business gave to others during that time?
Well, about $1 billion of investments happening downtown right now, which in some degree was due to our pioneering efforts and risk. And those businesses did not launder money. They're still in operation. Preservation Pub has been profitable from day one. Our businesses are profitable. That's why they exist. So there was not a false impression about the businesses. They've been successful from day one. People should want to be on Market Square. My big thing now is keep Knoxville scruffy, which means support local businesses. I don't want to see a bunch of Applebee's on Market Square. I want Market Square to be locally owned and operated stuff as much as possible. I've got nothing against chains. But I think what makes an area unique is the things that are unique to the place. In other words, you can't go to a mall in New York City and find an Earth Too Old City. You can't go to a mall in Los Angeles and find a Preservation Pub. But if you go in those malls, you won't know where you are. You could be anywhere in the country in a Simon Mall because it's all the same stores. Market Square is unique in the whole world. So I'm very proud of the fact that we created businesses on Market Square which are successful and define what Market Square means, which the most important thing we've done since we started is opening those businesses, which we were forced to do because nobody else would come into the spaces. Those businesses define downtown as a locally owned and operated, keep Knoxville scruffy space.
We were talking earlier in the show about, you said that, you know, you have moved on. You're not engaged in that kind of activity anymore. How important is it that message gets out for you as a businessman to be able to come back to the same space?
I think that most people in downtown Knoxville were very supportive of us, and they still are. They knew we did good. They knew we had good hearts. They knew we were trying to help downtown. The crime is federal. I was put in prison by the federal government, not downtown Knoxville. Downtown Knoxville never left me. They've always been supportive of me. They're my friends. When we got out, I didn't get any pushback. The pushback, I guess, from people that don't know me.
Well, I wanted to make this observation because in talking about doing this show and talking not just for the last couple of weeks, but over the years, people seem to love you or hate you.
And the ones that hate me, I would argue, I mean, it's possible, although being a confident human being, I'm going to just say it's not possible they could just hate me because of who I am. I would say that either they hate me because they don't know me, because I didn't screw over any of my friends ever or any business associates. I don't screw people over. I don't do that. Either they don't know me or there's envy. And there's a chapter in my book called The Seven Deadly Sins, yes, which is your favorite. And envy, I believe, is perhaps the most powerful emotion human beings have. It's right up there with love and hate. It's and that's schadenfreude. Envy is when you want to see that guy knocked off of that hill. It's a lot harder to climb a mountain than it is to knock somebody off of it and watch them slide down into the muck. It's a lot harder to stand to climb the mountain than to stand down there and throw rocks at a guy. It's easy to stand in one place and hope that the guy drops below you so you can feel superior. That's what I would argue is people that have it, you know, they get some pleasure. You know, Schadenfreude is enjoyment from another person's misfortune. And I think that's a very prevalent feeling in America today. And we all have it, but it's not a attractive emotion at all.
We just have about 30 seconds more left, and this is probably an unfair question to preface by saying we only have about 30 seconds. How are you different now than before you went to prison?
The world has caught up with me, and the marijuana is going to be legal. Downtown Knoxville is booming, you know, so I'm not going to be on the edge of the spear anymore. I was on the edge of the spear. Now the spear's behind. There's the army's marched in front of me. So all I would tell everyone listening is come downtown if you haven't been downtown in a long time. It's magical. It's amazing. There are tons of great shops and places to visit, pubs and retail shops and galleries and events all the time in beautiful historic buildings that are not strip malls. So come downtown and see the real Knoxville and support everything that makes us Scruffy City. So keep Knoxville Scruffy. Thank you very much.
We are out of time here on Dialogue. I want to thank Scott West for spending some time with us today. And remember, Scott will be Todd Steed's guest tonight on Studio 865, Flipside at 8:30 here on WUOT. Thanks also to Greg Hill and Megan Jamerson, who ran the board and handled the phones. And also looked at, kept an eye on social media. If you missed the show or you just want to hear it again, we should have it up on our webpage in the next hour or so. Just go to WUOT.org. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM WUOT and HD1 Knoxville and WUOT.org, a listener-supported service of the University of Tennessee.